presenter of today. I hope that my presentation will be engaging enough to keep you through this, this session. And from all the cities that we've seen today, I'll take you a little down south to the city of Surabaya in Indonesia. The city has many legends to explain whatever situations that are going on, including the name of the city itself. And I put this picture here. It's a fight between a shark and a crocodile. Basically, a shark and is called Ikan Sura, and a crocodile is Buaya, and it's a legend on how the name of the city came up. And this statue is actually in front of the zoo in Surabaya. So it's really interesting. I'm almost certain that there hasn't been any fight between a shark and a crocodile in that area. But it also reveals on how important the waterfront is to the city, because both the shark and the buaya and the crocodile, those are both creatures that are related to water. But my interest in looking into waterfronts and urban aspirations is also because first of all, a lot of Indonesian cities are either in the coastal areas or have a very significant presence of the river. The water is also a basic necessity. But at the same time, the waterfront is usually considered environmentally beyond city boundaries. So whatever decision that is in regards to rivers, coastal areas, usually they are regarded as something that is more regional. The water usually comes from outside the city for the rivers and so on. And also, the rivers, they are, historically, like in Surabaya, they have been used as trade paths to bring agricultural products from outside the city into the city. But at the same time, the waterfronts in the city, they are spaces of the life spaces of the people in the city. So you have a lot of competing interests going on along the water. So just a little bit into urban aspirations that I'm going to use in framing this presentation today. Aspirations, as Apadurai terms it, he calls it the culture that looks into the future. So instead of looking backwards, this is something that what people are projecting to the future from what they have now. Tim and Daniel wrote this paper, published in 2012, identifying three dynamics of urban aspiration in Asian cities that has to do with the domination of the developmental state, the tandem between the state and free market forces, and also the emergence of civic networks of middle class and the marginalized. We'll see bits of these in Surabaya later on. But I would also try to see how the aspirations of the people in this particular community that I was studying and am still studying, how they emerge, how they are formed, as well as how they are being constrained by all these dynamics. Urban aspirations in this presentation, I would also focus on the notion of the capacity to aspire by relating it with the experience in urban spaces. Because the marginalized, they are viewed as having less, relatively less resources to form to either aspire or to take action. But at the same time, how would they contest or alter the meanings of urban spaces? In this case, if we talk about waterfronts, they are considered even beyond the city boundaries. How do they have the resources to actually contest whatever is imagined by others, by policymakers, or by the state, or even by the free market forces, or whatever you want to name it, how they can contest that those images of the waterfront and to frame their own aspiration. So the capacity to aspire has something to do with power, social class, economic class, and more. And these are some images from the government of the city of Surabaya, there's this document about this particular river called Kali Mas. In English, it's Golden River. Mas is golden, Kali is river. So how they frame it is actually Surabaya has a lot of potential as a waterfront city. And Kali Mas, being one of the main branches of the Brantas River, which is the biggest river in East Java, is very historic, is the historic site of ancient kingdoms, Kediri, Singosari, and Majapahit. Majapahit used to be the biggest kingdom in Southeast Asia. Surabaya itself now has a population of 2.9 million. And Surabaya has been historically a port city since even the Majapahit era. It has something to do with trading in spices, and also it has been used during the colonial era as a collection point of farm products, sugar, coffee, tea, cotton, tobacco, to be sent to East Asia and to Europe. So it has always been developed as a port city, and especially Kali Mas has been this main river to actually carry all the products all the way down to the port. So the port is in the north, and then this river is going all the way up north. So the development of the city of Surabaya itself has always been very central. The river has always been very central. And during the colonial period, the city actually develops really along the river. The Europeans on the west side of the Red Bridge, and then the Chinese, Arabs, and Malays on the east side, and the Japanese all the way south. So the river has always been this this kind of reference point. So there are two urban villages that still exist until now along the river, which the names are Dinoyo and Bagong. They are the only two urban villages left on the Kali Mas waterfront, simply because it has been historically a trading line. So a lot of warehouses and factories were actually lining up along the river. Doesn't mean that there are not more than these two before. There had been more before, but there had been recently, relatively recently, revitalization of the river that actually tore down a lot of the kampongs along the river. So these are the two left. And speaking about doing ethnography and going to the site, actually I've started interest in studying Surabaya since last year, since Tim, Daniel, and the whole group was still working on the proposal for urban aspirations. And I was telling Tim, yeah, I will look at two cities, Jakarta and Surabaya. And speaking of the horror that Elaine was talking about before, about having delayed your research, imagine my horror when this book came out, and this book was on Surabaya, and guess what, there is a chapter on Dinoyo, and this is the whole ethnography in the Dinoyo Kampong. So I was when this book came out, I had mixed feelings. I was very happy that finally I have some literature to refer to, but at the same time, I was trying to make sure that I don't repeat too much that is inside this book. So here it is. I found that the book actually is very useful because it really saves me a lot of time in digging through a lot of archival materials and really give me a lot of information on what has been dug up and what hasn't. So also mentioned in this book, actually during 1965, the river was a site of horror because a lot of the bodies were killed. In 1965, there were mass killings of the people who are presumed communists in Indonesia, and a lot of the bodies were actually dumped in the river. And another book on Surabaya by Howard Dick mentioned that for weeks there were bodies floating in the Kali Mas until the government gave orders for cleanup. It was a brave man who had the courage to give any decent burials. So Surabaya was actually a hiding place for runaway communists at that time. And the history of this particular area called Dinoyo is actually, this area has existed for quite some time. And let me just show you the map here. So this is the river Kalimas, and Dinoyo is the one on the left side, the west side, and then this is Bagong Ginayan. And this is a zoom of that. This is Dinoyo. And what happened was that until now, the existence of Dinoyo, after some chats with the residents, they a lot of them has been there since for more than 50 years. And they came there during the boom of post-independence industrialization and also commercial development. Currently, a lot of them are working in informal employment, such as being street vendors, bamboo craftsmen, shop owners, and some work in factories, and some are civil servants. There are still some small prostitution businesses in the south, and in this book, Robbie Peters was saying that, you know, in Surabaya, there's this famous prostitution area called Doli, one of the biggest in Southeast Asia. And in Dinoyo, they have another one called Molly. And that was also one of the justification of doing this. This is actually some remains of the evictions that had happened before. So about 50 plus squatter shacks along the river was torn down to improve the appearance of the riverbank by eliminating prostitution and criminality. But still, when we did our study there, this was in 2012, and recently when I visited there last month, it was still around. So there are still some small prostitution businesses going on. But they also have regular communal neighborhood cleaning in Gotong Royong style. And there are also self-greening of the riverbank. So they have done a lot actually to improve the spaces along the river. So these are the greeneries that the Dinoyo community actually planted along the river. And the space along the river was reserved as a public space for them to gather and also to do their common activities. Most residents have family histories from outside Surabaya, but many have stayed there for decades and were born there. And this is an example of Mr. Mulyono. He became a Dinoyo resident when he married a daughter of a worker who resides in Dinoyo. So the worker was working in the factory, in a textile factory, and his wife was a daughter of the worker, and also and then he started living there, but then when the factory was closed down and the factory was converted into the state finance building, they continued to live there, but their children are already involved in other economic activities around, like the Kaputran market, and then also as religious teachers in the mosque. So actually, that's also how they get the name Dinoyo Tenun. Tenun refers to woven fabric, so that refers to this factory that produces fabric. But 40% of the residents are registered as poor. Registered means that they are holding some kind of card that identifies that they are recipients of some welfare support, either health or education or rice. But that's what constitutes this 40%. A lot of them actually have difficulty in getting pipe water supply service because they have no land certificates. They have difficulty in registering births because there is this restriction in making new family registration. So if you have, let's say, if you have grown-up kids, they get married, they form their own family, but they cannot live in Dinoyo as new family. If they want to live in Dinoyo, want to have existence in some family registration card, which is very essential in getting your identity card, then they have to register in the parents' family card. So a lot of the residents actually have intergenerational family registration cards. Usually in Indonesia, you only have like one piece of paper as your family, father, mother, and children. But in Dinoyo, a lot of families were having three pieces of paper, having father, mother, children, grandchildren, and so on and so forth, because they cannot obtain new family cards. So what do they actually want? They actually are hoping that there would be no more evictions going on, because they have seen a lot of evictions, although these communities who still stay here, they're the ones who are spared from the evictions, but they have been closed. They have been declared as a closed kampung, meaning there cannot be additional population to that particular kampung. They actually aspire to obtain support from the municipal government to revitalize their kampung, because all of these actually they have done on their own, including constructing this playground for the kids. And the reason why they do this is because they want to be acknowledged as just like any other kampungs in Surabaya. And this is very interesting, I think, because, and I took this picture because there's this banner here called the Shining Surabaya Green and Clean. And apparently the residents of Dinoyo is aspiring to be part of Surabaya, to be acknowledged as Surabaya, part of Surabaya, by portraying themselves as green and clean. And how they do this is because they can do this on their own. So, but I would also say that this kind of aspirational actions is not really generalizable for all riverfront communities. This is the other community, which is Bagong Ginayan. It also has more than 50 years of existence. Now it's about 217 households. But the community itself is not very, it's very interesting because the community is divided into three localities. RT means localities. But you can see that the composition of the locality is very different. In the first and second RT is 90% Maduranese, which is Madura is another island off coast of Surabaya, whereas in RT3 is 80% Javanese, and the reason is because RT3 is actually the police quarters. So most of the policemen were Javanese, while actually the migrants who settled in this kampung are from Madura. So in this particular area, the dynamics is quite different from what is going on in Dinoyo, although they also aspire to be acknowledged as part of Surabaya. But the way they want to be acknowledged is actually for them, it's very important to get land titles, land certificates. So although they were told that it's actually not possible because their land belongs to the Ministry of Public Works. Here you can see that 10% are registered as poor, and all are from particular part of the kampung. But most households actually earn more than the Surabaya minimum wage. So they are actually more well off than Dinoyo. But at the same time, you can see that their aspiration, so-called, is really different from what you see in Dinoyo. This is, again, going back to Dinoyo. This is what they do. If they cannot get pipe water supply, what they do is for houses who can get pipe water supply, they will save the water and kind of share it with the neighbors who don't get the water. But sharing meaning the neighbors can buy the water from them. That doesn't mean that the neighbors will not get water. So they will get the water somehow, but they do have this kind of collective effort to share the water. They also, in terms of recognition as part of Surabaya, they actually won awards in this kampung, these are the women of Dinoyo who actually won these awards for their activities. So I would also say that actually space can be, you know, the capacity to aspire. When they actually have space, they can implant their own imaginations of what they aspire to have or to be in the city, whereas the city can have its own definition of what kind of riverfront to be developed. This is from the city, you know, this is the kind of the riverfront, And you can see this this boat is the tourism that they want, that the city wants to develop along the Kalimas. In Dinoyo, they have their own boat, and this is very functional, actually, to cross the river. But as you can see, this imagination or this utilization of the river is really becomes very much integrated into their daily life practices, and this is also how they actually use the spaces along the river. This is their self-built, this is the place when you have those stones, the pebbles, to do some treatment on your feet. They made this along the riverfront, also on their own efforts, and this is just, I just feel that it's very interesting to put these pictures side by side of how you can imagine or reimagine how the river would look like. And these are the pictures from Dinoyo, and you can see all these are made by the people themselves. But again, these are actually quite different from the interpretation of the riverfront of that are imagined in the official documents. And you can see that there's this statue of the shark and the crocodile, again, to be repeated on the river, because it's the identity of the city. But at the same time, the residents of the kampung, particularly in Dinoyo, also, again, going back to the river as something that has more environmental component and is being viewed as something that is even beyond the territory or the policy boundaries of the city government, it's also something to do with the neighborhood is also being viewed as not having that much consideration for the environment in terms of their practices. And for example, this is a business of, this is very late in the day. I know the Indonesian word of it, but when you butcher the chicken here, they actually use this space. This is really along the river. And they still dump all the remains, the blood and everything, all the way straight to the river. And these are the practices that are still, you know, these are also identified with the way the community live their lives and also practice their economy. But at the same time, this also becomes a way in which that these communities are being marginalized in the sense that their practices are not really seen as something that that is good for the city and also the waterfront. So again, to go back to conclude that the water bodies in the city, they are often considered either city scale, regional scale, but definitely beyond the neighborhood. But at the same time, the immediate waterfront space actually is a part of the local neighborhood, and they become spatial expressions of aspiration. So the aspiration can be beyond the legal marginalization. In Indonesia, there's always this notion of the weak state and weak law enforcement. So they will always try to negotiate their existence with their expressions in the space. So they try to do this still within the constraints of the mainstream discourse of the ideal city, affected by the state and the free market forces, such as the clean and green. So this becomes actually the boundaries of the imagination. I wish to still continue this during our project. Hopefully we'll still have 2 years to come to follow the developments. But again, this communal interpretation and interventions of space, and also the capacity to aspire and seeing how they can relate or even limit each other. Thank you.